Welcome to the Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Two Lib Dems walk into a pub, and a fight breaks out. This week we're talking about Nick Clegg versus Vince Cable, why the Lib Dems can't hold it together, why the coalition's been so tough on them, and can they survive? And while we're on that subject, we also raise a toast to politicians who like a drink. I'm joined by The Telegraph's Benedict Brogan, Phil Johnson, Damien Thompson, and by Mark Littlewood of the IEA. Following the European elections, when the Lib Dems were reduced to just one measly MEP, Nick Clegg was hit by a plot so thick that you could call it stupid. Somewhere between Lord Oakeshott's insolent polls and Vince Cable's unlikely denials, we got a picture of a Lib Dem party that is going through a period of serious, even chaotic, self-doubt, asking itself why it's in government, what it's there to do. In fact, perhaps it's better understood as an identity crisis rather than a leadership crisis. I want to start by asking Benedict Brogan, just let us know what the latest is on this plot, where it's come from and where things stand right now.
Well, one gets a clear sense that the caravan has moved on in many ways, in the sense that it was a spectacular moment of high comedy and low farce, which saw Lord Oakeshott implode very publicly and Vince Cable damaged by the fallout. But it hasn't really carried through, because in a funny way, we didn't learn anything that we didn't already know, which is that the Lib Dems are in a very difficult position where they are agonizing about their popularity and their terrible standing in the polls and agonizing about what might happen to them next year. What's interesting, I find, is when you speak to Lib Dems in the calmness that has followed that storm, there is a fairly consistent message comes across, and you even get this from Tories, which is that however bad things may be for them now, come the general election, things might actually not turn out quite as bad, and those who predict a Lib Dem wipeout in 2015 might fall short of the mark, and that the Lib Dems might get away with losing no fewer than 15 or so seats and still remain a relatively useful force in a parliament should we get to another hung parliament and negotiations for a second coalition.
They're very good at luring expectations about themselves, aren't they? I remember on local election and Euro election night, Tim Farron on TV saying, well, we thought we'd get no votes and we got no votes, so really we're on target.
Well, I think there is if you look over the last few parliaments, it's always been the case that in between general elections, the Lib Dem vote has a knack for deflating quite considerably and then recovering come the general election. Certainly, one gets the impression that Nick Clegg's bet is that there is enough of a constituency out there for his kind of politics to give him a decent showing at a general election. Some speak of him hoping for 20-25%. I think that's way optimistic. But the Lib Dems, by the same token, won't end up next year with the kind of share of the vote that polls currently predict, some of them putting the Lib Dems as low as 6% or 9%. I don't think it'll be anything as bad as that.
Okay. Mark Littlewood joins us down the phone, who was formerly head of media for the Lib Dems. Mark, what happened to the Lib Dems when they entered the coalition, when they had that period of negotiation, that week in the garden where everything looked like they had finally accomplished something they hadn't done for nearly 100 years, entered government? What happened to the party when that occurred?
Well, I think they spent a bit too long congratulating themselves that they'd made it into government. And they had to do that, I think. I think all of these, looking back on it and asking, you know, should the Lib Dems still have sat on the opposition benches and should they have asked for some sort of confidence and supply arrangement with the Conservatives? Look, if you're the Liberal Democrats and you find yourself in the arithmetical fluke of a hung parliament and you're offered 5 seats round the cabinet table, if you're going to say no in those circumstances, then what on earth is the point of view as a political party? So they made the right thing by going into government. But then I think a number of rather serious strategic and tactical mistakes have been made. Firstly, I think that it does expose divisions within, ideological divisions within the Liberal Democrat Party between those of the Clegg, Danny Alexander, David Laws tendency who are perfectly happy working with the Conservatives and probably feel they have a little more in common with the Conservatives than they do with Labour, and the traditional left of the party who loathe the Conservative Party, see the Conservatives as the enemy, feel deeply uncomfortable about being in coalition, don't really say that too publicly because it would make them look like a protest party. They can't seem to be being against Liberal Democrats being in government, having been out for the best part of 100 years. But those divisions have been exposed. And then what's worse, I think, is this. The Lib Dems haven't really established what they're for in the coalition government. They point to, you know, two or three things that they claim to have achieved, such as the raising the income tax threshold. But that was hardly pushing water uphill. I mean, the Conservatives are very sympathetic to those sort of policies. Then they point to a load of things that they've blocked. But I think it's extremely difficult for political pundits, let alone the man in the street, to really discern what is it that the Liberal Democrats have brought to the table here. Why should you be thankful for the Liberal Democrats for what they've done over the past 4 years in government? And until they can answer that question, sort of what are we for, then I'm not sure that I share Ben's analysis. I think it's possible that the Liberal Democrats will only get 8-9% of the vote in the general election. I'm not saying likely, but I don't think that there's any obvious act of God that will, you know, necessarily add 5-10% onto their poll ratings.
Just to clarify, Mark, is it the case that you think they're not good at selling what they have brought to the coalition, or do you think it's the case that they simply haven't brought anything to the coalition?
I think it's actually both. I don't really buy this idea that the Liberal Democrats are saying that they need to shout louder about what they've achieved, because I think actually quite a lot of what they've done has been to block various moves by the Conservatives. And a lot of this, I'm sorry to give you the answer, sort of, I wouldn't have started from here, but I wonder whether, looking back at it, rather than the agreement they reached with the Conservatives, in which effectively every government department had some blue and some yellow representation, I think that would have been necessary in some government departments. Clearly, the Treasury, you needed to have both political parties overseeing the cuts and the fiscal retrenchment. But I think the Lib Dems would have been a lot better off to have actually had, let's say, two or three departments that were exclusively Liberal Democrat, rather than typically being the junior minister to a Conservative right across the board. And then they could have carved out whole areas of policy, which they could have said were distinctly Liberal Democrat.
Okay, I'm going to bring Ben in. Okay, Ben.
I wonder, I think Mark is right in putting his finger on the fundamental issue, which is that the Lib Dems haven't come up with a compelling and audible narrative about what they are actually for. But I wonder if one of the things that we learnt in 2010 is that partly as a result of a widespread dissatisfaction with politics and politicians post MPs' expenses, whether one of the things that they are for is that they are not the Conservatives, and that slightly underplayed argument, which says that they have acted as a moderating force on more traditional Conservative policies, is precisely what the electorate may have wanted when it voted for a hung parliament in 2010. And in a funny way, the very fact of not being Conservatives is one of their best-selling points.
I'll let Mark answer that and then come to Damien. Mark.
I think there is some truth in that, but my fear for the Liberal Democrats would be this, that if their proposition to the electorate is along the lines, and I'm caricaturing here what Ben has just said, but if it's along the lines of, if you basically like the coalition government, but you consider the Conservatives to be mean-spirited, rather evil right-wingers, then vote Liberal Democrat. If that is, in essence, their proposition, there is a segment of the electorate to whom that will appeal, but I think not a very big one. I mean, that probably is about 8 or 9% of the electorate who might sign up to that. So I think saying, well, we're a moderating force on the Conservatives isn't particularly attractive to those who lean towards the Conservatives anyway, who don't necessarily want the Conservatives moderated, and certainly isn't a sufficiently attractive argument to the people who dislike the Conservatives intensely. So okay. That's why you've seen so many Lib Dem votes switch to Labour. A lot of people would prefer to have a Labour government than vote for somebody who's going to moderate a party they don't much like.
Okay. Damien Thompson.
Well, I'm just glad that we're finally seeing this wretched little party in its true colours. I can't believe we've been sitting here talking seriously about the Liberal Democrats as if, A, they have some sort of coherent ideology they never have had, or B, that they're, serious and philanthropic in their aims. Over many years as a reporter, I've watched the sort of comic local authority backstabbing of the Lib Dems a local council level, in parliament, among activists. This is a small party which has the drawbacks of small parties, which is that eccentrics and opportunists tend to rise much faster than they would in bigger parties, and that partly explains why somebody like Norman Baker, and I'll say no more about him, just Google him, Norman Baker, is sitting in government, which is frankly an Alice in Wonderland outcome. It doesn't surprise me at all that this latest row involving Lord Oakeshott has broken out, because one thing Lib Dems are very, very good at is backstabbing. Or at least they're very keen on backstabbing, though they tend to do it in a rather amateurish way, which throws it onto a big screen. But, I mean, anybody who's familiar with the odious figure of Chris Huhne and the black propaganda he ran against William Hague, or indeed the nasty campaign which he ran against Nick Clegg, and then, typical to Lib Dem fashion, denied that he'd done that, will not be surprised at all by what's happening. One, the sheer malice that they bear towards each other. Two, their comic inability to keep it secret.
Isn't that a little bit surprising, given that they were always sold to us as the party of opposition, as the party of idealists and the honest people? I mean, many people in good faith will have voted for them as an alternative down throughout the years.
I think people voted for them as an alternative. That's not the same thing as voting. In fact, I'd say that's almost the opposite as voting for a party because of its political ideals. From the very formation of its party, going back to the days of liberals, if you say, what do these people stand for? Are they socialists? Are they capitalists? Are they control freaks? Are they libertarians? There's no simple answer. The one thing they stand for is furthering their own careers, and they've done that up to a point, but frankly, they're not up to the job.
But isn't it the case, though, that the charge sheet that Damien has so eloquently laid out about the Lib Dems could be applied to the other parties as well? Malice, backbiting, in it for themselves, unprincipled, there to sort of promote their own interests and grab power. You sound like that's the account of Labour in office, and certainly, to judge by the stories over the last few days between Michael Gove and Theresa May, it's precisely the kind of thing that we are familiar with the Conservatives.
And of course, one finds equally atrocious examples of behaviour in the mainstream parties, or entertaining examples, but the proportion of sort of homicidal nut jobs. Oh, I use the word homicidal. You'd almost think that the leader of the Liberal Party had been better keep clear of that. But anyway, the proportion is smaller. And there are, I mean, in the case of Michael Gove versus Theresa May, I have no sympathy whatsoever for Mrs. May, who I think has all the charm and ideology of a typical Lib Dem, but that you can at least see the outline of a serious ideological argument between the two of them. In the case of Huhne versus Clegg, it's basically a man who just wants to wipe out somebody standing in his way.
Okay, I'm going to bring Mark Littlewood in here because, obviously, for many years you were a Lib Dem, and I don't know, Mark, if you want to defend the party or agree with much of that, or if you think there was once a positive alternative Lib Dem vision for the country and it's become lost.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are lots of different strands within the Liberal Democrats. I completely agree with Damien. You can't discern what you could reasonably call as an ideology.
But a bit of a problem for a party, I would have thought. But
a bit of
mind.
A problem, but I mean, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party contain lots of different strands as well. I think there is a sort of policy agenda that you could discern, which has been, until quite recently, rather different from that of the Conservatives and the Labour Party. I would say in three areas, and this, I think, also goes to the recent failures of the Liberal Democrats. The Lib Dems have always been strongly in favour of constitutional and electoral reform. Well, they managed to blow that completely with the AV referendum, but nevertheless, that has been a point of distinction. They've always been the most, I suppose you could say, internationalist, but certainly most pro-EU political party. Well, they made a complete hash of that with regard to the European elections, the party of in not proving to be a particularly popular slogan. And then thirdly, I would think in the area of civil liberties, the Liberal Democrats have been rather more consistent, at least on, if you like, judicial liberties. They've been much less consistent on sort of libertarian lifestyle issues. But on civil liberties, the Liberal Democrats have been consistent. But there, the Conservatives have largely moved their tanks onto the Liberal Democrats' lawn under Cameron. So it wasn't as if there was a big battle between the two coalition parties on whether to repeal ID cards, for example.
And also, Mark, you are largely describing social issues. During a period of recession and austerity, when the things people really care about are the economy, is this just not the Lib Dems' moment? Maybe in 2005, when the Iraq War was happening and Charlie Kearney's Lib Dems did seem like an exciting liberal left alternative to Labour, that may have made some sense. But during a recession, is all the stuff you've mentioned really stuff people notice?
No, I don't think it is. And electoral reform, certainly, whilst it obsesses sort of liberal Democrats, has never been something that, you know, energises a particularly high proportion of the electorate. And one of my great disappointments, both when I was working for the Liberal Democrats and since, has been that on the economy, the broad approach of the Lib Dems has always been to say, whatever the prevailing level of state spending is, we'd like to spend just a tiny bit more, almost irrespective of whether times are good or times are tough. And I don't think that that is a remotely ideologically coherent approach to government.
Can I butt in here and just say, I sum it up this way. If you are primarily a party of opportunists, which is who the Lib Dems are, opportunists, then your moment will come and go very, very quickly indeed, and it's gone, thank God.
Damien, were you not at all impressed by the visit to the pub?
The visit to the pub was hilarious. It's the sort of comedy that they do very well. Though I suspect if you actually found yourself in a pub with Lib Dems, they'd be drinking half pints and arguing over whose round it was.
Also, 11:30 in the morning, that's not a healthy sign. I don't want my deputy prime minister going to the pub at 11:30 in the morning. That's
surely politics, we need to go back to the days when people went to the pub at 11:30 in the morning. That's what's missing from politics.
We do, and more on that subject later. Mark Littlewood, Benedict Brogan and Damien Thompson, thank you all very much. We will be back after this brief message from Peter Oborne.
Gordon Brown drunk was a better man than Harold Wilson sober. And there was a view that your political careers could be floated on a sort of sea of whiskies and beer and brandy. And Winston Churchill, of course, was a manifestation of that. And broadly speaking, the worst politics, I mean, George W. Bush didn't drink in office very much, and that was probably the worst president of the United States in the last 150 years.
That was Peter Oborne speaking about how sad it is that politicians don't drink enough. A new biography of Roy Jenkins points out that he used to enjoy taking two-hour lunches and that many bottles of wine would be consumed during that. And yet it doesn't seem to have particularly damaged his career. In fact, his biographer states, quote, that he spent his life doing little else except eat, drink, and talk. Why is it that politicians today are so sober, and has it improved their job performance, or are they actually less interesting because of it? Damien Thompson, you've been around the block a bit when it comes
to indeed, yes.
Politics and drink.
Yes.
And do you think this is true, that politicians drink less nowadays?
I'm absolutely sure it's true that politicians drink less nowadays. I think it's also true that politicians are less interesting, have less of an intellectual hinterland and are generally less amusing than they used to be. Whether there's a sort of causal correlation between that and the fact that they drink less, I don't know. But I think I'd make a distinction between the culture of lunching, which was something I associate with, you know, it died out in the, perhaps in the 80s as the world speeded up.
Yeah.
A culture of getting drunk. And we've talked about Roy Jenkins. He strikes me as somebody who was a very agreeable luncher, but not really a drunk. But if you read, say, the Crossman Diaries, it's clear that George Brown was a proper drunk and that this enormously hampered his ability.
Yeah, that's George Brown, who was sort of deputy prime minister under Harold Wilson,
right.
I think,
yeah.
And who famously met what he thought was a young lady at a party and invited her for a drink, and she replied, no, because first of all, I'm a man, and second of all, I'm an archbishop. Mm-hmm. Phil Johnson, have the sort of social rules of being a politician changed in the last 20 or 30 years?
Certainly from the point of view of being appearing drunk anywhere, in fact. I mean, the George Brown story, which really was his undoing, was when he actually collapsed in the gutter in front of a newspaper camera sometime in the late 60s and was replaced by Harold Wilson. Of course, famously in the House of Commons in the 1983 or so, Alan Clark, in his first job as a minister, was drunk on duty, or I think tired and emotional on duty, as they used to say. And this was pointed out by Claire Short, a rising young left-wing firebrand Labour MP. But I think it was ruled as unparliamentary to point out the fact that the minister was...
Claire Short, who never touched a drop herself.
Claire Short. So, I mean, yes, can we trace the date? I think probably to the moment that the new Labour came into office.
Right.
Certainly down at Westminster. Suddenly Perrier bottles started appearing at lunch tables rather than two bottles of claret, which is the usual sustenance for a lunch. I can remember highly regarded and very brilliant political editors wouldn't even turn up at their desks until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, having been to Reform or the Garrick or wherever for lunch, usually with the Chancellor of the Exchequer or the Foreign Secretary or with various members of the Cabinet, and would be extremely well informed if they could remember what they were told, of course.
Because this wasn't a new culture of drinking in politics. It certainly dates back to the 18th century, the end of the 18th century, early 19th century, when... William Pitt the Younger was known to actually go behind the Speaker's chair to throw up. Things are a little bit more civilised than that. So sometimes quite unlikely people can turn out to be fond of the odd glass on a hot day, as we say. For example, Margaret Thatcher.
Yes.
Did like her whisky and would stay up. And people said she only slept 4 hours a night. Well, one of the reasons for that, I think, was she sat up nursing more than one glass of single malt.
Yeah.
Talking politics, I'm sure, because I don't think she talked anything else, but she certainly liked a dram.
And it's also not a uniquely British thing either. I mean, we can say this now because Teddy Kennedy has sadly died, but he was a man who liked glass. And there's a wonderful occasion.
A glass and a line.
and some yogurt. Ice cream was his thing, actually. There was a wonderful moment in the early 70s where he went to Alaska to visit the Native American tribes out there. And on the plane on the way back, he got hammered and ran up and down shouting Eskimo power and tried to seduce a hostess in the lavatory. And a good friend of mine also told me that she was in a saloon in Washington, D.C. recently and encountered a very well-known senator. And the senator drunkenly asked her if she would like to go to bed with him. And she replied, "Senator, if you can actually get out of that chair and give me a kiss, I will say yes." And he sort of mulled it over for a few seconds and then said, "Fair enough, I'll pass." Phil Johnson, do you think there's actually a link between the changing sort of political ideologies in Britain and the decline of drink? You mentioned New Labour. Is there actually something about the Puritanism and the nannying nature of New Labour?
Yes, there was a bit. But don't forget, it's not only politicians where drinking culture has declined, it's in the media as well.
Right.
I mean, there was a symbiotic drinking relationship between the two classes of politicians and journalists, which has subsided largely because it was a bit difficult to turn up for lunch with a politician and demand a bottle of wine when they're not drinking at all.
But also, I speak as somebody who was a boozy journalist but then gave up the source, much to the relief of my employers. But we talk a lot about the culture of lunching, and indeed there was a culture of lunching. As a very enthusiastic boozer, I never liked that. I never liked the sensation of... It was fun at the time, I suppose, for the first hour or two, you'd sit there with your contact and you'd... I think Keith Waterhouse said the loveliest sentence in the English language was, "Shall we have a third bottle?" But after the third bottle, you had to go back to work, you had to write your copy, and
the headache would set in, and then
you'd have to make the decision, and I'm very ashamed of all this, but nonetheless, you'd have to make the decision, well, do I go back out to the pub, in which case I'll get very drunk very fast, or do I go home, in which case I'll be a headache, I'll be in a bad mood and sleep badly.
Yeah.
So... I've given up booze anyway, but I don't think that the culture of boozy lunching was necessarily as much fun as it sounds.
No.
And there's a difference between whether it was fun and whether it was good for the country.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, for those who are involved in it, the journalists and the ministers. In fact, it's a long time since I had a two-bottle lunch with a cabinet minister, probably about 15 years now. But, it was good. That was enjoyable. But I'm sure that they didn't function very well when they went back to the desk in the afternoon. I'm sure as hell I didn't. So, it was. We've lost something there. And I mean, Jamin's right about Pitt, but it's a bit unfair on Pitt because he was actually, I think he was prescribed port for his health, which then exacerbated his gout. But, of course, the greatest Prime Minister of the 20th century, Winston Churchill, would have a bottle of champagne, Paul Roger always, in bed in the morning
yes.
before he got up. So didn't do him much harm.
And he was 50-50 whether or not he would attend cabinet meetings, wasn't it? Which is
the Americans were utterly freaked out when they came over and during the war, and would meet the British Prime Minister, who was under the weather before noon.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, that's hypocritical because
American drinking culture is different anyway. Oh,
but Richard Nixon would agree with you on no drinking during the afternoon policy. But my goodness, he certainly did it during the evening. And there's a marvelous story where he had a party of people and he wanted to impress them because he was slightly hammered on his favorite whiskey. So he called up the head of the army and said, "Bomb Syria, bomb them now," just to prove that he could do it. Terrifying to think that finger was hovering, quivering over the nuclear button. Damien Thompson and Phil Johnson, thank you both very, very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.